Thanks so much for being here. I see some new faces and some friendly returning faces and faces that I've met in different parts of the village. I'm thrilled to be here. This is my second time here at Holden on teaching faculty, and hoping, I think, when Sharon had emailed me last year and said, hey, or the year before, hey, you know, have you thought about coming and doing this? I think there's been ongoing discussion about the importance of these topics here in the village. So I've been really honored and continue to be honored to engage in these conversations. I also think these conversations are generative. So I have an agenda because that's the good professor in me. And I also am happy to go off script, you know, so I have put some things together. For our time together today, I'll just tell you what I've put up, what I put together, and then we can fix it if you want. If we could start maybe introducing, just so we know who's here in this conversation, in this space. And then I have some recap. So earlier this week on Monday, we had a conversation with adults in the village about some of their questions around gender identity and sexual orientation, kind of an introduction to some of these concepts and topics, questions that came up. And then I met with some youth, and we have a small number of youth that came. But I, as a qualitative researcher, am interested in the depth of the conversation more so than the generalizable large numbers. So while we had a small group, we had a mighty group. And there was an 11-year-old, two 12-year-olds, an 18-year-old, and a 27-year-old that participated in the conversation. And they have some really rich ideas that they wanted shared in this time today. So we'll look at what adults said, we'll look at what some of the youth said, and then make sense of some of that. I also know, I felt a bit like the Monday conversation was a tad unfinished because I think folks still had conversation or questions around gender identity. So I included a little bit, a few more resources, and we can talk about that or not. The Gender Unicorn is a really fun graphic to help us start to understand. So I've included that in the PowerPoint, but again, we can mix the PowerPoint so we don't have to stay on it. So those are some of my thoughts for today. Does anybody have anything that you'd like to add or take away at this point? And then we can kind of edit as we go. Sounds like an okay plan? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. All right, well, as Sharon said, I'm Kristen. I was at NDSU for 10 years and most recently have just finished my first year at Appalachian State. And as of July 1, I will be the program director of the Marriage and Family Therapy Program. I am a licensed marriage and family therapist by trade and also train future clinicians and have a background as a sexuality educator as well. My scholarship is very much focused on LGBT inclusion and families. And this really came up for me, particularly around gender identity. As I was starting my dissertation process, I happened to take a gender theory course, which was not in my plan of study at all and not even in my my discipline at Virginia Tech. And it just opened my eyes to so many issues that are relevant to families that in my master's degree and I was at the end of my PhD training as a marriage and family therapist, we'd never talked about. Just never talked about gender identity, trans identities, gender expression, intersex conditions. And I went, these are such tremendous family issues and relational issues. Since then, our pop culture has caught up a bit. And so now we are hearing more about gender identities in the media. You know, when Chaz Bono disclosed his identity, of course, we've all heard about Caitlyn Jenner. And then with popularity of shows like Orange is the New Black and Laverne Cox, and, you know, trailblazers like Janet Mock, who have written wonderful books and are really doing a tremendous job of educating the general public about the intersection of being a Black trans woman. You know, we've seen that this has come into more of our public discourse. So I think it's really a timely moment for us to be discussing gender identity and also remembering that there are gay and lesbian kids that are still being shunned in their families and rejected from their faith communities, and bisexual people who, while they are the largest percentage of the LGBT community, get the least amount of attention, the least amount of recognition, and the least amount of honoring of their identities as well. So that's a mouthful of why I'm here and what I do. But I'm wondering if you might say who you are, where you're from, and what you're hoping for in this conversation.
in and volunteering for middle school and high school here at Holden. And so I'm in this conversation because that age group is invited, and also because I'm really interested in this topic, and I'm just excited to learn more and hear about the discussion that's going on.
Thanks.
I'm in this conversation because I want to learn about dresses and food.
Awesome.
And I'm just hoping to learn more about these topics, and I know a lot of people who are shunned from, you know, like their faith and families, and I'm just here to learn more about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Same thing, I'm here to learn more. It seems like my children in school have a vast more knowledge that's been incorporated into their education about gender identity, mm-hmm. and I feel like I'm really still trying to catch up. And I work with youth in my occupation, so I feel like I really need to know more.
And I think you are describing part of the reason that this has happened the way it's happened in terms of having adult conversation, youth conversation, that came up last year, and what your point comes up in so many conversations I'm a part of. But, you know, adults have lots of questions about things that kids seem to be part of their normed conversations. Mm-hmm. So thank you for saying that, and I think you're right on par with a lot of people.
We have a transgender daughter, and my interest is understand. We have a very supportive faith community, but awesome. I know that's a challenge for some, and I want to know how to have those conversations with those who are not on the same place we are in the continuum mm-hmm. discussion about faith.
Can I ask your denomination?
We're Presbyterian.
Wonderful.
And United Church of Christ. We're a blended church.
Great.
And I'm here for the same reason.
Awesome. Welcome.
Probably identify as bisexual, I'm not sure. And I'm just curious, the history of the binary and maybe the church's involvement in that.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
Great.
Pretty well connected in the Lutheran organizations within the state and elsewhere, and would be happy to share that.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you.
What I hope to get from the conversation is I'm very supportive of what people, who they are, what they want to be, and how they want to be it.
Mm-hmm.
I just would like to expand my knowledge on it.
Sure, great. Thank you for being here.
And queer identify myself and work as a campus pastor at a Lutheran university where a lot of the college students are LGBTQ identified. And so I just kind of feel like I want to keep up with things that are changing and recognizing that my experience has been different than theirs. And so just, like what's going on now for teenagers as they become college students.
Great.
Queer identified and I think personally I sort of live in a progressive bubble around these conversations, but I'm a public librarian, so professionally I don't live in that bubble, and I think I'm just kind of interested in kind of exploring more of the spectrum mm-hmm. of conversations around this, where people are, where are people struggling in ways that I might not be mm-hmm. aware of, even though I think I am, and just kind of being in a conversation with them.
Sure, great. Well, thank you all. We have Illinois representing definitely today. And you all relocated from Illinois.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. So we all good with maybe going through some recaps of earlier conversations this week? Okay. I don't know if this thing will work or not. I'm going to try. Okay. So when we started the conversation on Monday with adults, these are, and if you, some of you were here, you can kind of tell me if I captured it accurately. Some of the themes that came up in regards to interest of conversation, some of which we got to, some of which we didn't, centered around how moving to be a more inclusive church. And I think some of these themes have come up today, being more better understanding of gender language, especially, supporting kids who experience bullying, supporting congregations who are inclusive, increasing awareness. I think that seems to be a general theme today, too. Just increasing all of our awareness and how to be sensitive in our language. Questions about, there was a one specific question that came up about including LGBTQ youth in research. That was specific to a scholar who was in the audience, or audience, the conversation. And then health and families. And so we addressed some of this. We talked about the distinctions between gender identity and sexual orientation. Do folks want to touch on that? Because we have some new people that are here. Would that be helpful to make those distinctions? Okay. And particularly in faith communities, oftentimes I will say, I'll call them exclusionary faith communities. Communities that have not taken the steps to be inclusive or are exclusive, very intentionally exclusive. So I'll say even discriminatory. That there's conflation of sexual orientation and gender identity as though they are one thing. Or there's an erasure of transgender identities. Well, we're hearing that in the media quite a bit, that there's no such thing as being transgender, or conflating it with a mental health disorder, which is not true. So LGB people do not have a mental health disorder. People who are transgender, fortunately, are scholars and folks that keep rewriting the DSM, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, in which all of our diagnoses for mental health conditions come out of, have now removed gender identity disorder. So we don't disorder people's identities anymore. That is now focused on dysphoria. So people who experience physiological or psychological distress based on their gender and their experience, that is a diagnosis. Being transgender is not a diagnosis. That gets a little tricky because folks who are wanting to pursue any kind of hormone treatment, depending on the endocrinologist or a physician for different kinds of surgical interventions, sometimes require a diagnosis. So it creates this bind that somebody might be just fine, but know that they'd like their body to be more consistent with their identity, then have to be diagnosed with a condition that they may not actually experience in order to have access to treatment. So you can see we have a long way to go. I could go down a rabbit hole on this topic. I'll stay focused. But I want to introduce it just to problematize what's happening, particularly for transgender people. So we see a conflation of sexual orientation and gender identity. And if we're going to talk really simply, identity is who we are, how we experience ourselves, right? So how we experience our gender for ourselves and in the world. And then how we express it would be our gender expression. My sexual orientation, your sexual orientation, we all have a sexual orientation, is who we are attracted to romantically, sexually, relationally. So that's an outward. Does that make sense? So identity is inward. Orientation is outward. And they're very different. And we all have a sexual orientation. We all have a gender identity. We just don't talk about it unless you're part of a marginalized or underrepresented group. Right? We don't have a model of cisgender identity development. So if you're not transgender, we don't even have that kind of language around gender identity development, except for at age 2 or 3, kids figure out their gender. So. Are there specific questions about language that would be helpful?
I just use queer general for the whole category. Is that obtuse or?
Right. So this conversation happened on Monday too. I think there's lots of questions around what language is okay to use. And I encourage you to focus on the person. If you're in a conversation with an individual or a small group, ask those people. And there's a lot of politicking around language, and so I would say yes and no. I identify as queer. That's a better fit for me. I also am in conversation and part of professional organizations with people who are 10, 20 years older than me who experience that word as a slur. They have no interest in reclaiming it, and really don't like to be referred to as queer. And at the same time, we have queer theology. We have queer studies. Our scholastic discussion and discourse includes the word queer. So, I don't have a clean answer to say, yes, that's okay, no, that's not. I think be mindful of the conversation of the people you're with, and also how it can be. I've heard people talk about queer youth, and then I've heard people say queer in a way that was very, just the tone of their voice made it very clear that they were not talking in a positive and inclusive way. So how we use language matters too. We can extend that to pronouns for folks. I don't ask these questions publicly. If we're in a group like this, I wouldn't say, hey, what's your pronoun? That forces people to maybe be public about something they don't want to be public about. And at the same time, if I'm in a one-on-one conversation and it seems like that would be a good question, I might say, how do you want me to refer to you? And then people can tell you. And I have yet to have somebody say, I can't believe you asked me that. Right? Oftentimes people appreciate being asked so that we can honor their identity. Because language matters, right? Language is incredibly affirming. There's a term called dead naming. Has anybody heard that term?
What is it?
Dead naming. And that's when, and it's sometimes done in a very kind of verbally violent way, that when somebody is has chosen a name that better fits their gender identity, and somebody, like, for example, calling Caitlyn Jenner Bruce Jenner is dead naming Caitlyn Jenner. I'm not a fan of Caitlyn Jenner, so I hate using that example, but I think it's one we all know. She hasn't quite figured out how to be a good ally to her community, but that's a whole conversation for another day. But that's the example. So when people intentionally use a name that doesn't fit an individual's experience, that's called dead naming. And so there are ways that language is used to discredit, to dishonor, to you know, kind of put somebody in their place or let them know that they're not supported. So,
Kristen?
Mm-hmm.
Using it, because I'm at the age where queer was very, very negative.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so how is it that they're now using to use that as an identity?
That's a great question. So it's in some ways we see people that have reclaimed it and said, I'm taking that word back. If you look at the history of the word queer, it does not have a long-term pejorative history. It has been used as a slur, but if you look at the original origins of the word, it means different. So and that is even different than the term homosexual, which only has a pejorative history. So there's never been a time when that word was used in a way that was inclusive and meant to celebrate an identity or was okay. It's always been used to diagnose, hospitalize, or police people. So that would be a pejorative term that's not been reclaimed and probably will not be. So queer can, if we think about queer theory, that's a way, in some of my scholarship, we talk about queering the family, and that means creating non-normative ways of existing. So in families, it means moving out of what we've known as like the standard North American family, which would be a mother, father, and a child and a white picket fence, right? And moving into, you could queer a straight family. So there's mom and dad's staying at home, and mom is the breadwinner, right? They are doing family differently in a way that defies the gender norms that we've all been socialized into. So some of the queerest people I've known are straight people. So I throw that one out there. So it's been used in multiple ways. So I mean, you could talk, you know, there's like the scholarly academic way of thinking about queer is rejecting categories. And we're hearing youth talk about queer in that way, where you're not, I won't fit into your box. I don't even want to check a box that's LGB. Anything else. Like, I'm queer, and I don't have to explain what that means to you. Or, I am ever evolving, and this word fits me best. So I don't know if that answers the question. It probably confuses it more, but in a way that we understand a little more understanding of it. Okay, great. Other questions? Or words that you've heard that you're maybe not certain about?
Cisgender?
Yes, thank you. I used that term and I didn't unpack it. Yeah, so cisgender is a term that was developed probably in the last 15 years. And it comes from the Latin root, cis comes from the Latin word same, meaning that people whose sex assigned at birth matches their gender identity. So I am a cisgender woman. I was assigned female at birth. I identify as a woman. And it gives us a way to talk about people who live with some gender privilege, right? So when you're cisgender, you don't have to worry that you'll be rejected by a physician or denied medical care because of your gender identity. And that is unfortunately an all too common occurrence for people. And I could go on, I could go on with a very long list, but it helps me to recognize ways that I can live and that not think about these kinds of things. Nobody looks at me twice when I go and buy jeans at the store, actually regardless of what, if I go to the men's section or the women's section. That is not the case for all people. You know, is it safe for me to get a haircut? You know, everyday kinds of living experiences, as well as things that are more important and imperative to our existence, like health insurance. If you are transgender, there's a very good chance that there are clauses written into your health insurance policy that will deny any coverage related to trans health care. Right? I don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. So that's that. If that helps unpack some of like what it means to be cisgender. Thank you. And it's an academic term, and I hate sometimes in mixed audiences like talking like an academic, but we're also hearing more young people use this language.
Yeah, I think it's becoming more common.
Yeah, so you'll hear things like cis norm, which means cisgender normative, which means kind of what we expect for people who aren't trans and the kind of privileges they live with, the things they don't have to think about. So you're hearing some of that, what used to be even 5-10 years ago, kind of more academic speak as part of the language of young people today.
Let me just throw this out. Friends of ours had a daughter or son in college, and this child was bringing friends back. There was a break, some holiday or something, and so said, you know, that this group of students and their daughter came home and said, well, there's one more person coming. So they were trying to figure out bedrooms and all of this. And so the father said, well, how many other people are coming? And she said, well, they are coming. And he said, but how many other people are coming? They're coming, they'll all be here. And this was a person who felt they were male and female.
Mm-hmm.
And so the parents learned a little something there.
So they, them. Great. Thank you for bringing that up. And in our last session, we had somebody here whose child is very involved in the They, Them Project, which is based in Minneapolis. I encourage you, once you're out of the village and have access to technology, to Google or look that up. It's a great project, and it addresses the experiences of non-binary, gender fluid, gender expansive, gender creative. There's lots of words we can talk about that expand our ideas, our binary ideas of gender. Binary meaning we've all been socialized to believe you can either be a boy or you can be a girl. There's only two choices, right? You male or female. You are a woman or you are a man. You know, God defies that in intersex conditions, really. If we think about people who have in the past been referred to as hermaphrodite, that is a pejorative term, we don't use it anymore, but conditions where people have ambiguous genitalia or develop conditions of puberty that really blur our understanding of, you know, kind of biological chromosome bodily recognitions of sex. So gender creative, expansive, non-binary people do that in their social lives and their lived experience as well. Some people, I think they're very, very public about that. My daughter's birth mother, who refers to themselves as a birth mother, uses they, their pronouns and identifies as non-binary and is very public about that. In fact, I think might be thrilled that we're talking about it today, and because very much wants to help people understand that experience. And so some days they are more masculine presenting, and some days they are more feminine presenting, and that fits for them. That really messes with people who haven't thought about these issues. And there are, in fact, you know, this becomes even problematic in, and I don't want to speak for the trans community. I will say that in my conversations in larger trans spaces, which are not owned by me, there are trans people who feel like the binary is important. and really struggle with non-binary identities. So, you know, this is not like a one-size-fits-all, everybody gets it and understands. There's still, there's a lot of variation in experience, identity, and gatekeeping as to what's okay and what's not okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of related to that, I think there's a trend towards trans folks being resentful that they have to present as their chosen gender. So that idea that I can be a woman, but I don't have to shave. And
yes.
that's hard for a lot of people. That mm-hmm. if you're calling yourself a woman, for God's sake, dress like a woman, you know?
Yep.
Get over it. And so that's an interesting thing to watch.
Yep. And people who deem themselves as progressive. Right. Like, I support you when you're being trans, but can you not mess with this? Like, if you're going to be a woman, be a woman. If you're going to be a man, be a man. Right. Right? And that doesn't fit everybody's identities.
It extends to surgeries that are...
Yes.
That are
none of our business, really.
None of our business. and deforming of your body, and deforming mm-hmm. of the body that God gave you, that you can choose to keep. But how you identify doesn't relate to that. So that's messing with a lot of people's minds. Mm-hmm. They're just having trouble wrapping their brain around that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And a quick, simple way that I put it is, if you think that there are only two recipes for people, male or female, you're wrong.
Yeah.
An easy way around the number thing in situations is to get the right verb to say they is coming. It's singular.
I think it's the Oxford Dictionary. There's been changes in recent texts that dictate our type of language, because I've heard that argument too. That's grammatically incorrect. Actually, it's not anymore. Right? And there are often times we have used they, them in a singular sense, but it wasn't about gender. And nobody questioned it. But now that we're using it in this very intentional way, it's gotten politicized. And there are pockets of people who are uncomfortable with that. But they, them is a way to either avoid talking about gender. So I'll sometimes use they, them if I'm not certain and I don't want to misgender somebody, or until I've had the opportunity to ask them what pronoun they'd like me to use. And then some people, that is the preferred pronoun. Actually, I don't want to use that word. For a long time, we called them preferred pronouns. We're not calling them preferred pronouns anymore. And that's an important distinction, because this isn't about preference indicates choice rather than honoring people's identity. So just people's pronouns. It's just your pronouns. So I'm having to reprogram myself, too, after years of talking in one way. And that's my privilege, right? I get to decide. I get to have to be aware rather than, you know, think about that differently.
Sure. So the pronouns, project that you talk about. Mm-hmm. So that it's about individuals being able to choose their pronoun. Or do they go further and say easier if we just used they?
I think it's
or is it both?
I don't have expertise. I've seen it on social media, and there was a parent here whose child is involved. Yeah. Yeah. So I would suggest we should all look it up.
Yeah.
What I understand is that it's an advocacy organization for non-binary people. And so something that's come up in my own research, a couple of years ago, I interviewed parents from across the country who are raising children who are gender creative, expansive, transgender. I didn't define that, but if their child's experience was outside of a binary normative experience, they were welcome to participate. And what was very interesting is that I found that the parents of non-binary children really struggled to find any support. Because even when they found, trans youth support groups or parent groups for trans kids, they were still very binary and focused on, medical interventions like hormone blockers or kind of figuring out these very real issues for trans kids. But there wasn't really a place for them, for their non-binary kid, and for them as a parent to connect with other parents of non-binary kids and kind of navigate that, because navigating systems with a non-binary kid is a completely different ballgame in many ways from navigating school and medical systems and families of a trans kid who is very clear in a binary gender identity. Caitlin,
Is there a pronoun that's spelled XI?
Yeah, there are a variety. I'm not even going to try and define all of them. Yes, so there is Z. Yes, there are a variety of pronouns, non-binary pronouns that people have developed that better fit for them. So they might not use they, them, they might use z or zer, and that is ever evolving, and that's why it's important to always ask.
Sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm. That's where my hope is it will come down with one pronoun for all of us and just
right.
Forget about it. You're a human being, you right. Qualify. I used E for years, just the letter E, and it works sometimes.
I just recently saw an article about a new, instead of Miss, Mrs., Mr., it's MX, I'm not sure how it's pronounced.
Mix, mm-hmm.
What is it?
Mix, I think.
Say that again?
Mix, like
mix?
M-I-X, but
mix. Mix. Okay, mix.
Mix.
So, yeah, so we're seeing, you know, language is ever-evolving. And language has always been ever-evolving. Mm-hmm. We just tend as a culture to get real uncomfortable around certain topics as they evolve, right? Particularly around this, so. And feeling like I have to keep up with this and know every single word there is to know. And I want to encourage you that if you are open and you are loving and you are compassionate and you are authentic, that comes through. If you mess up a pronoun and you are all those other things, that's much more important. You'll get corrected, right? It is much more important to be those things than to always get the word right. But then when you are told, this is how I identify, it's important that we honor that. You know, so you wanna then make the effort. But I think on one hand, it's really important to talk about language and to explore it and unpack it. And then the other hand, it's really important to remember that first and foremost, relationships matter. Raphael, how are you doing? This conversation's probably, I don't know, might be a little boring at the moment. Yeah. What do you think would be important for us to talk about? Well, how about this? I'll stop putting you on the spot. Because that sometimes, I guess, not cool of me. But know that you are welcome at any point to say, I want to talk about this. Okay? Is that a good deal? Right. Well, maybe what I can do is move into...
I did have a question because is there, and I don't know how to state this, it seems like a lot of children who are going through puberty are beginning to not necessarily identify them as bi or whatever, but they're beginning to question it more than maybe people did at my age. You may have felt it, but you never identified and saying, I have a friend who has a 14-year-old granddaughter, and she said, well, my friend and I, we don't know what we are. You know, we don't know if we're bi, or we don't know if we're... So is this something that is new?
I would say it's something that we learned more about back when Alfred Kinsey was doing research in the 50s. And he also lost all of his funding because he talked about what he found. So he was the first researcher in Western culture to go out and interview people. And he interviewed thousands of people about their experiences of relationship and sexuality. And what he found, his first book was about men, and he was celebrated and on the cover of Time magazine. His second book was about women. All hell broke loose. He lost his funding. He was just terrible. If you've ever watched, you can watch the film Kinsey, which is about Alfred Kinsey's life, but also you can read about Kinsey. You can find those articles. But what he did, he was the first person in Western culture, I think, and maybe even in the world, to really do a large-scale study that found that how people perform publicly is not how they practice and love relationally in their private lives. And so he was the first to find, actually, we have a lot of people who are LGBT, that most people, if you heard of the Kinsey scale, mm-hmm. most people fall somewhere in the middle. If we have a polar feminine, masculine, male, female, polar ends, most people are not on the end, mm-hmm. even if they don't tell you that, mm-hmm. right? Particularly with our ideas around masculinity. But most people are somewhere in the middle. They might be on either, kind of lean towards more the end, like for me. I definitely lean more, I'm way down the scale on terms of sexual orientation, on more queer, lesbian identified, but who knows, I say that now, I mean, it's unlikely, but it's not impossible. My mother would be smiling on that. but most people don't identify on either end, but our culture tells us otherwise. The possibility of embracing the complexity of human experience and human sexuality and human relationship has been very limited by faith beliefs, right? By the church. If you really want a good, dense read, but one that gets into all this, I highly recommend Human Sexuality, Volume 2 by Foucault, who really gets into the role of like the Catholic confessional and the way that our systems dictate our beliefs around sexuality and how the church has been involved in those constructions. And if you look broadly across history and across world history, sexual orientation has been embraced and condemned in various points in times in various locations throughout history. This is not a new issue. We talk about it like it's a new issue. It is not. It's forever existed. As long as people have existed, diverse gender identities and sexual orientations have existed. Their acceptance, embraced, their ability to be embraced, and their celebration have varied across time. But identities have not changed. So you ask a great question. So these young people, they're 14, and they're saying, hey, we're not sure. I think that's probably most adolescents' experiences, but that is not something that would be encouraged, right?
Well, has the church throughout history kind of downplayed this whole aspect, especially now with some of the issues of the conservative Christians who are, you know, very strongly against it? Has this been kind of a norm for the church throughout?
Well, I don't feel like I am probably best equipped to answer that question. What I can tell you is that the Bible never once, well, I shouldn't say that because there's some speculation that some scripture does, but it doesn't outwardly address loving same-sex relationships. It addresses same-sex rape between boys and men and sodomy, but you don't hear stories of loving relationship, like loving lesbian relationship, although there's some speculation about some biblical characters, right? Depending on who you're talking to. So there's been much interpretation.
You don't even actually really hear much about different sex loving
right.
relationships in the Bible, right? That's not what relationships were about for the most part. I mean, there's some hints, but...
Even in heterosexual relationships.
Like, biblical relational values, you're like, wow, interesting. Like, rape, concubines,
right.
marrying a pair of sisters, like, yeah, lots of
things. So. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Should we move on? All right, so here are some of the other points that came up at the end of that discussion. What are some of the questions that adults had? And I'll tell you, this session evolved from my being here in the Village last summer, where my series focused on gender identity, faith, and family, and we had several youth that were coming to workshops. So Sharon and I were talking, and we thought, well, let's you know, really allow for more exploration. We'll do an adult workshop, we'll do more of a youth workshop. But as we all know, the Village evolves every week, every day. and so we didn't have a large group, particularly of LGBT-identified youth or questioning youth, which there were that were showing up last year. So you just don't know who's going to come. So I think our questions and not knowing who was going to be at the youth workshop, some of them were focused, I think, towards kids that might identify as LGBTQ+. And those questions weren't answered in our conversation, but we still have some rich things to talk about. So I wanted to just share the summary of the adult conversation on Monday, things that they wanted to share with the children and youth session, which is, it gets better. There's a whole campaign focused on it gets better. And what I think what's important is that there are amazing videos that are you know, like celebrities and politicians and sometimes people you would least expect to write a video about it gets better, hold on. And that campaign developed out of a response to queer youth suicides that have been a part of our culture for a very, very long time. The media finally picked up on it a couple years ago and started reporting on it. And people went, oh my gosh, this is happening. And so one of the responses is it gets better. So that's kind of a promise. That, like, if you can get through this really crappy time in childhood and adulthood where people might not be nice to you, you can have this awesome life. True and problematic, right? Because some of the critique of that is, well, what do we need to do to make it better now? So there's, you know, there's both. So I'm going to hold both, that it is really important that we have these wonderful, you know, I'm looking just here today of adults who are, I'm going to assume, happy and successful and in loving relationships. And that offers, I think, promise and hope. And that's really important to young people. And how do we allow more of that experience as they are young people, rather than something that they can achieve later? So some other things that came up were more questions about the importance of identity labels and language, which I think we've been talking about here today. Can we ask pronouns? And so that was a question that was posed to youth. And I'll say, I'm going to allow myself a little agency in saying yes. Common practice, best practice is to go ahead and ask. But again, if we go back to relationship, how do we ask, where do we ask, and when do we ask? Do we ask in a big group, you know, where there's a youth event and we put somebody on the spot because we're uncertain because they have presented in an ambiguous way? No, don't do that. But you might see them come in the door and say, hey, we're so glad you're here. How do you identify in a one-on-one conversation? What would you, you know, we generally go around and introduce ourselves. How would you like to do that?
You have seen the name tags that ask for pronouns.
Yes, and there's some mixed, yes, those are very well intended. And I think there's also mixed feedback that comes from what space is that in. So those can be really, so what we're talking about are the name tags with your pronoun markers. So I might have a name tag that says Kristen, she, her, hers, right? And that's something that really well-intended cisgender people do. It's also something that trans advocates do in trans-only spaces so that people have a sense of the identities. Where it gets, like, if I were to do that here and we had a trans person or a non-binary person in the room, it inadvertently others them and discloses something that they may or may not want to disclose in a room full of, I'm going to guess, predominantly cisgender people. So it can serve a really great purpose in the right spaces. So if it's like a predominantly queer space, I'm all about it. In a space like us today, I would never do it for that, for these reasons. So, you know, again, relationships, context, all matter. But thank you for bringing that up.
I think there's something about offering your pronouns.
Yes.
As just like a signal. So like on my email signature,
yes,
at the university, I've got my pronouns listed. On my university name tag, and a lot of people do, I just have my pronouns there. So that's like a cue to people that like, oh, you kind of understand the concept of pronouns. Yeah. Maybe I could. So it's not like asking every single person I meet what are your pronouns, but it's like it's a signal, a cue.
Yes. So, and that's what's so important, and we're going to talk about today too. What are the signals that people know, okay, this is an okay person, right? And so indicating your pronouns without asking in a public space for somebody else's, those are cues that mean nothing to people who don't, it doesn't matter. Does that make sense? So if it matters to you and you see that somebody's indicated their gender markers, that's a sense. Like Jen was saying, like you get it, you have some sense of what's going on. To somebody who's cisgender, maybe never thought about gender identity, that's, they're gonna be able, it doesn't mean anything, right? It's not important. And so there was another question about how to address identity topics with youth at various developmental stages and various experiences of understanding diverse identities. So the example was like, it was actually the pronoun doing exactly, funny that that came up. It was an example of a youth leader who had asked a group of young people to share their pronouns, and some of the kids really didn't understand what was going on, and there wasn't much context to that conversation, kind of how do we handle those situations. So some questions about how do we, these are sensitive topics that are more meaningful to some kids than they are to others, and so how do we talk about that in mixed spaces? So those are some of the questions that came up. Raphael, this might be the part where you want to jump in if you want, okay? So this is what the kids had to say. So you can say if you agree or not, if you want to. You don't have to. So we had a conversation with youth in one of the chalets the other day, and I asked what makes an inclusive community? Like, what does community mean to them? And these are their responses. Inclusive community includes good people. The belief among adults that kids have ideas too, right? They're not empty slates. They have ideas. They can contribute in really meaningful ways. That the adults trust each other and also trust the young people within the community. That the adults honor that kids can make their own decisions about who they are, and that they believe and honor their identities. I thought that was really profound. That kids know who they are. And that might be evolving, but whoever they say they are today should be honored and not questioned. Adults and members of the community say things so kids know it's a safe place. What I loved about this, we ended up having a conversation about what would happen if a kid came out as gay in their youth groups. And they talked about how they all think that they'd be really embraced in the faith communities they were a part of, which I think were like Lutheran and Presbyterian. But they knew it was that way because the adults are always saying things so that the kids already know. And I thought, this is like, if you look at the best practice resources, that's exactly what we're told to do, right? To do things that indicate a safe space. And I'm going to caveat that and say I don't think there's anything such thing as a safe space. But it's a safer place, a safer space, that there is a safe adult, that we're trying to get it in some way. Know that you don't always know. They're saying that to adults. I thought that, I'm just going to let that one sit. And I loved this one. Trans kids need to know that even if kids are mean at school, that church is a safe place for them, and that we need to be speaking up about this. Is church typically a safe place for trans kids?
Yeah, not always.
No. And even in well-intended communities, it's still not always a place where they are honored and feel safe. Feel validated. And that's quite important, I think, especially for communities who have maybe gone through the process of being reconciling or being open and affirming, or be whatever your denomination calls that process of saying, hey, we embrace LGBT people. Oftentimes, especially people, especially organizations and communities who have gone through that process before the last 5 to 10 years, we didn't know nearly as much. We weren't having nearly as many conversations about gender identity. So you might have a community that's really great for a new gay couple, but they still aren't really sure what to do when a person who presents in an ambiguous gender way comes and asks to use the bathroom. Right? That happened in my own community.
So one of the really interesting conversations that Rich and I had with a beloved member of our church, our church is very overtly inclusive, in a way that excludes people who are uncomfortable with that.
Who aren't there yet.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we had this really great conversation with this wonderful woman who's been a member of our church for many, many, many years about our trans daughter. And she said, I don't get it yet. I'm just not there yet. And it was this great conversation where we were able to say, yeah, okay, so let's talk about it, right? And I think that sometimes while we are well-intentioned, we don't accept everybody where they are.
And I think that's part of the intention.
If where they are isn't far enough along.
So making space for people who have more work to do.
Right.
Right. And that can be quite challenging.
What I appreciated about this woman was that she was honest about it.
Yeah.
She didn't just clam up.
Mm-hmm.
She was like, I want to be there, I think, but I don't know how to get there.
Right.
You know?
And so there are folks that maybe are in that kind of camp that are going to show up to an adult ed and say, hey, I want to learn more.
Right.
And there's a whole lot of people in that camp that are like, I don't get it, and I'm not coming on a Thursday night.
Well,
right? You know, and so how do we embrace those people? And I think what I would, like, the easier thing that I'm going to, the idea I'll send out with you is always encouraging people to hold on to their ethic of love. So if we are a loving faith community, you don't have to get it. You don't have to get everything. Now, that's great. Moving into a space of getting it is really important, if possible. Holding on to the belief that all people are wonderfully and beautifully created by God and have value in our community, if they can hold on to that, that matters.
I think also that totally relates to you talk about race in that last.
Yeah, I love this kid. This was a little boy in the discussion was like, we haven't talked about race yet, and we need to talk about race. And I was like, hallelujah. Yeah, we do.
What I wanted to relate to is that I've come across some people recently who have tried to discuss racial issues with them, and their response is, well, you know, I grew up in an all-white community, and I never lived around any black people or Hispanic people. And I didn't know there was poverty because I never saw it. And so, you know, I think you have to be exposed in a way that makes you feel comfortable, and it is a process. But so whether it's your sexuality or whether it's your race or whatever it is, people have to be somewhat introduced to it in a way that gradually they're going to learn more about it, if they're willing to do that. They just don't block it off and say, oh, I'm not going to even relate to that. But I think right now the whole race issue has become more front here again as people are doing things that hadn't been done for a period of time, as overt as it's being done.
Right.
So I think that's anything that you have not been connected to or understood. I had a niece who she thought that she wanted to become a man. And she was living with somebody who wanted to become a woman. And so it was like, to me, it was like, I don't understand this at all, you know? And so that whole process of trying to begin to understand, and then she turned back to being heterosexual. She's married again and has a couple more children. And so, you know, I think that question is as to where you're at. And if you're not exposed to it anyway at all, you don't understand it.
Well, I think first, my initial response is people are very complex. And so we oftentimes will think about, particularly sexual orientation, as being this fixed, you're in this fixed place. And I, you know, I'm thinking about a woman I know who was married for decades and loved her husband beyond measure. And he passed away. And she found herself in a relationship with a woman. And all these people are questioning, oh, were you in the closet all these years? No, she wasn't in the closet. She was very much in love with her husband. And then she met a woman who she fell very much in love with. Sexuality is not static. It's fluid. And we know that. Research tells us that. But then our cultural norms don't necessarily get what we know about human experience. So thank you for bringing up, I think, too, yeah, you make a good point around people's experience and exposure to lives that are different than their own experience. And at the same time, that's where we have responsibility to understand, you know, why is it so important to understand, and I'm going to go here, to understand what's happening with, you know, Kaepernick and kneeling and why that's relevant. If we think about the NFL and the amount of spousal abuse and violence that happens and drug use among the players that never get any attention, and you have a young man who is kneeling in protest of police brutality, and it's become headlines, and the president of our country is talking about it. We can't extrapolate that from the race issues and racism that is prevalent in our country. So I think, you know, talking about differences and how that relates to this particular group of people, to LGBT youth, are. And we call that intersectionality and positionality, like where are people situated? So a young person who has a supportive family and they are, their family maybe lives in poverty and they are African American and they are trans. Depending on their space and place and who they're with, are at more or less risk for being the target of violence and discrimination, for experiencing their own sense of depression or suicidality or substance use, you know, reducing risk factors requires that we pay attention to all of the different identity categories that people exist in, and that we understand that one size does not fit all. That a 14-year-old gay boy is not going to have a shared, there'll be some aspects of shared experience and then some vast difference among family, relationship, subcultures, race, ability. And there's quite a movement right now of LGBTQ folks who are part of the disability community, mm-hmm. And talking about their needs and talk about having your sexuality erased. Mm-hmm. Right? So these are all really relevant issues. So I just loved that he brought that up. I think it's important for all of us to know that one of the highest risk groups are trans women or trans feminine identified people of color. In terms of being targets of physical violence and the victims of fatality.
Mm-hmm. So my mom works with people with disabilities, so I get to meet a lot of those people too. And I think that a lot of people forget that they're also people with sexualities and they have gender identities too. And just because maybe that they can't speak as well or they act differently doesn't mean that they aren't the same as us.
Absolutely. And so you bring up such an important topic, right? That somehow or another we look at people who live with a disability as not having a sexual experience. And again, a lot of what we're talking about, both gender identity, sexual orientation for all bodies, is reduced to what we believe, and y'all bear with me on this, but what people's private parts look like. And who we think what private parts are supposed to do what they do. Being careful. And that is especially true. I think we can apply that logic to the way that we erase sexuality for people who live with disability. That, you know, the biggest sex organ is what? Does everybody know?
Brain.
It's our brain, right? But we think it's other body parts. We act as though it's other body parts. And so that means that somebody who is paralyzed from the chest down still has a gender identity, they still have a sexual orientation, and they still have sexual desire. Right? That doesn't...
Yeah, it was kind of, I don't know, it was a comment I read that said, we color code our infants so that strangers will know what genitals they have.
Yes.
And I thought, how bizarre when you think of it that way. Mm-hmm. And then I was also just thinking about how people who have disabilities often sort of feel invisible in general in society,
yeah.
And so it's mm-hmm. hard to, and people don't recognize the other parts of their complex lives.
Absolutely. Things like that. So to be invisible, especially if you live with a person who lives with a physical disability, mm-hmm. and then there are so many hidden disabilities, mm-hmm. things that we don't, you know, that you don't see, and we make assumptions about people and how they're supposed to be, and that also can be very, erasing, I don't have a good word, sense of invisibility, right? So that's why I say, if I go back to there's no such thing as a safe place, a safe space, even when we're trying, there's things that we might miss or ways that we can do better for more members of community. I'm going to, just for time's sake, move on to the next slide of what the youth said, although we can continue talking about any point you want to. So what they said they wanted from community was for it to be safer for them, for all people, to be accepting to everyone, to be loving, to be understanding, to be helpful, to be kind. And they said kind altogether. There was this very follow-up to this point, that treating LGBTQ plus people like you would all people and don't pretend about it. So they talked about if somebody comes to your church and people say, oh, hi, nice to meet you, come have some coffee, and then they don't ever talk to them again, that was pretending. I was like, all right. So what they were basically getting, if I'm going to put my adult spin on it, is that this is an ongoing, engaged process where we're ongoing, extending an ongoing welcome, right? And doing the work ongoing. And that's what they said with the ongoing welcome and acceptance, not just one time or one statement. That it's something that had to keep doing. And these points were primarily made by the 11 and 2 12-year-olds. comments or questions about that?
It's kind of a general thing. At least as Lutherans in our church, for anyone coming in, we certainly could improve our Seattle nice is the term for the West Coast. Oh, hi, how are you? And then just kind of disappear. And people from the South, especially, go, they're not going to invite me over for dinner or whatever. So I think in all around,
I just think the youth should be in charge. They have really good ideas. Right, and so I think I'm gonna skip this one. Because I came up based on these conversations and then my own experiences and reading of best practices, I put together some questions that I thought we could talk about in regards to what you think might be possible, what might be challenging. We can also skip this if you look at it and go, I don't want to do that. But I thought this might kind of switch things up a little bit to address some of those suggestions and questions.
The best sign that I've seen is ones where they switch some restrooms around and they just put, like, if it had a urinal and a toilet, they just put an icon on that. If it had two toilets, they put an icon on that.
Yeah.
That's what's in there.
And I have a colleague who is out trans-identified, who worked for a big extensions in Minnesota, Extension Service, who has a whole document that's what they suggest. Rather than labeling gender at all, you just put what's in the bathroom.
Yeah, cool.
So people know what the facility is and they use the facility that works for them. Right? Yes.
I've heard too, like the word gender inclusive instead of gender neutral.
Yes. Did I put neutral? I did put neutral, didn't I? Yeah, gender inclusive or all gender. Like all gender restroom. Yes. Actually, gender is never neutral. I don't even want that on there.
But I like the idea of like there's a toilet in here.
Yep.
If that's what you're looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was talking with somebody who about they weren't seeing why it would be necessary to have bathrooms other than male and female marked bathrooms. And I said, you're not going to believe this, but I bet you have a gender inclusive bathroom in your very own home.
Yeah. Right?
I know I have one.
I think, though, if they're multi, like I think single person bathrooms, like that totally makes sense. They should all just be. But yeah. I think there can be some safety issues around multiple people bathrooms. And just how to pay attention to that.
If the community has not done the work, then you want to be really careful about labeling a multi-use restroom as something that would appear to be safer than what it actually is. So oftentimes when I'm talking with people, there is a single stall restroom somewhere in the building. So a first step could be labeling it as all gender, gender inclusive. And that is different than even labeling it as a single stall. When you actually address gender, it shows some recognition. And then having that information posted somewhere. So if it's in the basement, which is a bit of an inconvenience, at the same time, you have a sign that says all gender restroom located in this part of the building. When people come in, they don't have to ask about it and they just know where to go. That creates a more inclusive experience potentially.
It's also functional, like curb cuts are great for bicycles and strollers besides wheelchairs, that young children with the opposite gender parent who wants to have some control over what's going on in the bathroom needs to know that there's a single stall.
And this is an accessibility issue as well, as we were talking about disability. I have a colleague who we started really working on my professional organization and making sure that the conference have appropriately labeled restrooms. And he and I had a conversation because he is an adult caregiver to his daughter. His daughter is an adult and cannot use the restroom on her own. And they have a very difficult time going anywhere because he can't go into the women's room and she can't go into the men's room. She's not eight. Right? She's in her 30s, but he is her caregiver, so he does that. And so having those opportunities, those spaces are really important. And so this is also like pie in the sky, but if you have a new building being resurrected, and making sure that there are single stall restrooms included. It's much easier to include it in a new project than it is to retrofit an old building, which many of us are existing in old buildings. However, you know, sometimes we have a new education building or something that's happening that's really important.
So we have, I mean, I've had conversation already with Kristen, but in our lodges at Holden, you know, it, because most, I mean, all of them certainly don't have, you know, they're not single stall, you know, single shower, you know, and it's an issue, you know, and it gets to money and remodel, you know, and so it's hard.
It is.
Yeah.
Can I ask that question? I don't know if we have time. Where is Holden Village on this continuum of awareness and acceptance for
Sharon?
Well, I think as far as the bathroom issue, or no? Okay, I'll go back. Well, I don't think we'll ever be where we maybe could be, should be, but I think we're
welcoming up all people.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. But this is, if we talk about, because we had a J-term student that was in Lodge 1 this winter that pointed out some very things that we need to think about.
Mm-hmm. But you're listening.
We're listening, we're asking good advice, but our issue often comes, you know, when it's remodeling, money, staff to do it. But it's not because we don't want to do it. Do we have the time and the right people to be able to do it? But that's better than shoving the advice aside and saying it's not important.
33 years ago, we were married here.
Wow.
Yes.
So I had to wait a while for the legality.
Organizing the what was it, Gay Pride Day in 1992?
Yes.
You know, I think this has changed the Lutheran Church.
Reconciling in Christ is the Lutheran organization, and you Presbyterians must know about More Light
and Open and Affirming in the UCC Church.
Yes, and. So, and I don't know if you've seen the film For the Bible Tells Me So.
Yeah.
It's dated.
Yes.
It's hard to watch. But yeah. Sometimes for some people, it'll wake up.
Okay. Yeah.
And then Open Door Ministries, did I mention that? This is a Lutheran ministry that's been going on for 25 years, started, I think, when AIDS first began. And the present chaplain has a Baptist background, but he's been chaplain of this particular organization for a long time. And Google Open Door Ministries, if you're unfamiliar with that.
Also, I have resources at the end. Welcoming Resources is a non-denominational but faith-based, and that's a website. There's a website and there's resource guides, and there's actually a guide specific to being gender affirming. Mm-hmm. And there's a 3-part series that they suggest. And I've used some of that curriculum in my former faith community that was very helpful. And they are under the LGBT Task Force, which is a national advocacy organization. So you can find the resource online. But I believe it's welcomingresources.org, if I'm not mistaken. I have the link on here. I do it on time. So the other, you know, issues to ponder are, is your church leadership aware and connected with regional LGBTQ organizations? Are youth leaders, do they know if there is an LGBTQ youth group in your region? Would they know where to send a kid or refer? Are youth events gender exclusive? So I know I was at a church and it was a UCC, Open and Affirming, marched in the Pride Parade every year. I had done an adult education series on gender inclusivity, and they did a spa event for girls in the youth group.
I don't think that would happen.
They have somebody in the congregation owned they didn't just like go find one, but and I think it was very well intended. And then when I asked about it, they said, oh, well, anybody can come. But it was something that was really advertised for, you know, based on gender. And at the same time, there was another event happening that was for boys.
Right.
Is that happening? And what does that do? First of all, that doesn't even have to do with gender. It is about gender identity, but it's also about messages of boys being able to be pampered and girls being able to engage in things that are more mechanical. So there are other gender things going on there. But then it also becomes exclusionary for kids that, you know, identify in diverse gender ways. Has there been a discussion among leadership about how to support LGBTQ plus youth rather than reactions to when youth disclose or come out? Which is generally what we end up doing, is responding or reacting to something rather than saying, hey, this is how we want to handle, this is how we want to be supportive, and having that be part of the discourse. You know, is there a plan? Would a person in leadership, would a youth leader tell a parent? Would they not? Have they grappled? I mean, there's a lot of ethical questions about what you do when a minor discloses information. And has there been discussion? Is there a plan? Sometimes disclosing to parents can be the most dangerous thing we can do to a child. And sometimes helping that child disclose to their parents can be the most life-saving thing we can do for a child. You know, and there's not a one-size-fits-all. But understanding that complexity and being able to gauge those situations and having dialogue among leadership is so incredibly important. Is there LGBTQ visibility in the faith community? Are there people in leadership positions serving on the council, singing in the choir? Do LGBTQ people come to the church? If they do, why? If they do not, why? Are there youth in leadership or consultation positions? Like, I really think that these youth that showed up the other day, they need to be running things, right? Do they have a voice in their communities? Is there space for them? Do they, you know, maybe even consultation? Hey, we're thinking about this event or doing this thing. What do you think? Does the community participate in pride events? And that can, you do not have to be open and affirming or resurrecting or reconciling or any of the designations to participate in pride. However, if you have a congregation that isn't quite there yet, there might be a lot of backlash if you're participating in pride. So I don't say this as this is an easy thing to do, but I think it's something to be thinking about. Is there an interfaith service that your community can be a part of? And maybe if they're not a part of, that you would be going to and be willing to take youth with you. So you might not even be on the sponsor list, right? But if you know that there's a young person that's come out to you in your community, or that's something that you just want youth to be able to attend, hey, we're going to this event, you know, ask your parents if you want to come. Are LGBTQ concerns addressed during, I say prayers for the people if you're in a Lutheran community, but at the time in your service when community and global issues are being talked about, is there any intention to address LGBTQ? Celebrations, concerns, you know, when legislation happens that's inclusive, does that get announced? Those are also, as we were talking about, like gender markers on an email, that says something to the community. Those kinds of announcements says something to the community as well. And I'll even, Sharon, can I share our conversation?
Sure, okay. And I can give a better response.
Great. Well, I'm sure there's always a reason, but I was thrilled, yesterday? In the morning, during morning announcements, that there was queer lunch. And then I went, why isn't queer lunch on the schedule? And so I found Sharon, and it came up with a couple of people, like, what is this queer lunch? And what we were talking about is there's something about, like, the visibility of having it. You know, so there's the technicality of people being able to organize and be there if they're LGBT identified. And then there's also a statement to the community that even if nobody shows up for lunch, that it was on the calendar and that it was, you know, scheduled. And there's, you know, more of the,
right,
in how things work.
Right. And you're very right in all of that. The reason it wasn't on is because program staff who make the schedule weren't told that it was happening.
And I kind of figured there was some kind of technicality.
And then it happens if there is a staff member who's willing to lead it, and that is fluid. In the sense of sometimes some weeks there is someone and sometimes there is. And then they've also had the, I don't know if it's issue, but during the months when it isn't high guest season, that really is for LGBTQ plus and allies, not everybody. Do you see, you know, so do we put it on the calendar or we don't? So that's the rationale. I'm not saying it's the right rationale.
Yes. I have some thoughts we can talk later.
Yeah, but if they don't know about it, they can't put it on.
Right.
Bottom line. So.
And I think this is a wonderful example for you will have, like, this isn't, it's not a huge deal.
Yeah.
And in the same way,
it is.
It kind of is. I mean, it is and it isn't, but it sends a message to a community. So you can probably think about in your own communities moments where something similar has happened. And so I just think it's a great example of, and it's something that people are grappling with. Like, do you institutionalize it? Does it matter if there's a staff person that's willing to lead it? Or do you just say it's happening on this day at this table or this space and just kind of see who shows up? Like, it kind of, that intention depends. I'm not saying that it should or shouldn't. It depends on what the purpose and intention.
Mm-hmm.
In our church, we had kind of the reverse happening, that LGBTQ events would happen, but they were only known by that community. Mm-hmm. So there was a missed opportunity for inclusivity going the other direction.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was like, well, nobody else would be interested. Well, that's not true either. And so I think there's this, you have to go past that and just say we're all a community and whoever shows up.
And there's oftentimes time and places where queer spaces are important and that's protected. I have met many a very well-intended ally who in a moment of crisis were not the most supportive. And so this is where intentionality matters.
For this lunch. Mm-hmm. So it's like,
And clear conversation, I think that's where the clear conversation about what's the intention of what we're doing.
Right.
Are we creating a community event that's for everyone? That's important. It's important that everybody know about it. Is this an event that's specific to youth, an LGBT identified youth?
Yeah.
Because they have their own unique needs and also a need for safety. As safe as we can make that space for people who have a shared experience. You know, it depends. I'm not saying any is right or wrong. It depends on the context and the circumstances and the intention of what's happening in that moment. I think we've talked about some of these things, and I know we're coming up on time. So I have some resources. I can email these out, or if you want to take photos, feel free. Trans Faith Online, I've pulled up more trans organizations, so that seemed to be where people had more questions.
Could we just give you our email addresses?
Yes, if you want to write them down, I can send this to you.
Okay.
I'd be happy to. I can also share them with Sharon so that they're here.
How long are you around
here? I leave tomorrow.
Whoops. Okay.
Uh-huh. But we could write them down. If you want to write them down before you leave on a piece of paper, I'm happy to send them. I wanted to share this as a resource. I think this is a great place for people to start talking about gender identity and sexual orientation. And this is a response. We've heard of the gingerbread or the genderbread man. Don't use that. It was, some of it is plagiarized. There's problems with it. So this was the response in a way that is more inclusive and not plagiarized. It's the gender unicorn. And so this is actually a worksheet. So what people can do is put where on each of these scales they identify themselves. And every person can fill this out, right? This is a great activity to do with youth. But they can put, so if you look under gender identity, they have female, woman, girl. My issue with this is that the word female refers to sex rather than gender, but we can look past that. So where people identify in terms of binary genders and then non-binary genders. So you might see that somebody identifies really far on the female or like the feminine. if I got to rewrite this, it would just say feminine and masculine. Like, in terms of femininity, and they might write lower masculinity, but maybe somewhere in the middle in a non-binary way. And that kind of just allows people to be complex in their orientations or their identities or the way, and then that might or might not show up in how they express themselves. And so you just kind of put a little dot on the arrow as to where you lie. This helps me remember to talk about sex assigned at birth. So that is language to refer to, you know, when somebody is born, what does the doctor say? You have a boy, you have a girl, right? That's not uncommon. We call it sex assigned at birth, which is a movement away from calling a person a biological sex. That's not necessarily always correct. And it also comes across as kind of definitive. So we assign people a sex at birth, and they may or may not experience their identity that way as they develop. So this allows for people to say how I was assigned, and then who am I attracted to? Men, women, other genders, diverse genders, and then who am I emotionally attracted to? That's another piece we didn't even talk about in terms of sexual orientation. There are plenty of people who engage in physical relationships with people who are not people who that they would necessarily be emotionally attracted to.
What about asexuality?
Yes, and that was part of the reason this was developed, because that was a problem on the gingerbread.
But that seems like a problem here, too. Like
here?
If I were asexual, I'm not sure where I would put physically attracted to and emotionally attracted to.
Low. It would be at the 0 points.
Oh, I get it. I get it.
Where before it was like a all-on spectrum, and that didn't fit. It was actually people from the asexual community that said, this doesn't fit for me.
Got it.
It doesn't mean I don't have a sexuality. My sexuality just doesn't, because it was kind of scaled. And they were like, being asexual doesn't mean I don't have a sexuality.
That's
asexual is my sexuality. Yeah. Great question. Thank you for bringing that up.
Okay. The other gender or genders?
That might be non-binary genders.
Yeah. A mix of, mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's what I thought, but I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So it's kind of my definition of what, if I were filling it out, that would be, I would get to define what.
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. All right.
Yes. And the way it kind of, it actually shows on the graphic, the unicorn here has a symbol for, that is a like a biological symbol between the legs. And then there's a heart symbol. And then there's a brain symbol for identity. Right? And those things sometimes align with our normative ideas, and sometimes they are all mixed up. And that all of those are valued.
I love the emotionally attractive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's an important distinction.
Oh, okay.
Because you may, like, there are jokes, but I'm trying to keep this age appropriate. Where, you know, young people may, well, not even young people, all people can engage in all kinds of relationships, right? And they aren't necessarily defining. We also live in a culture that can sometimes dehumanize people based on their identities or their orientations. So if you look at the Center for Disease Control, when they are doing HIV/AIDS outreach and STI reduction work, they ask people, like they use terms like men who have sex with men, very intentionally, because that captures a whole demographic of men who do not identify as gay. So these,
can you say that again?
So they will ask questions for specifically for men who have sex with men, but may not identify as gay.
That's what I need help.
Their behavior may not dictate how they identify in the world or how they even talk about who they are. And that's culturally determined too.
Yeah.
So and
so
I mean,
they
that's
might
a whole
be, but they don't identify as.
I would
not
say
even.
They
that's
are
not
or
even
they aren't. I mean, there are some people who
engage
in physical relationships with lots of people,
yeah.
But that might not be who they love or date or marry or, you know.
Yep, I got it.
And then there are some people who are closeted. you know, there's such a variation. So I know that we are coming up on time, and you know, I always have more slides than what I need, but is there anything that we did not talk about that you hoped we would talk about today? Any lingering questions, comments? If you have ideas about how I could do this better, please feel free to share them in the evaluations. I will say, I think my shortcoming for today, again, when I envisioned this, I had this grand idea that there would be a bunch of youth in the room. So I do think our conversation was probably a little more adult-oriented than it was inclusive of youth, and I am aware of that, and kind of grappled throughout with how do I do this? And I never did figure it out. So thank you all for being here, and I do apologize for not doing that better. And if you have ideas about how I can do that better, I'm all ears. So I'll end on my own self-critique. Thank you all so much. Thank you for being a part of this conversation.